nature about interfering with nature is that you must interfere. There is no way of not interfering. Even when you look at something, you interfere with it. It is your very existence is an interference with the environment from a certain point of view. So there you are, you're stuck with it. Everything you do alters the balance. Even if you sit perfectly still, you're still breathing. And that alters the nature of things going on around you. You're exuding temperature, and that changes something. And then when you start eating and doing all sorts of things like that, you really do start changing things. So you can't avoid interfering, and yet the maxim is don't interfere, but it means bestly translated, don't force it. So then what do you do? Well, you have to interfere as wisely as possible. That is to say, you have to find out how to interfere along the lines in which things are already developing. You simply use the wind by putting up a sheet. But then, supposing the wind isn't going where you want to go, then you learn to tack. But you keep the wind in your sails all the time, and you use the wind to go against the wind. And therefrom comes the idea of judo. Judo is the Japanese way of saying the gentle Tao, the gentle way. And in judo, the basic principle of the whole thing is that you are not an attacker. The underneath judo is a deeper philosophy called Aikido, the way of Aiki. And Aikido is that you can never be attacked. Because when somebody attacks you, you're not there. Or, you are there, but in the form of a vacuum. So that the attacker gets sucked in so fast by his own force that he falls over. So in judo, one always uses the strength of the opponent to bring about his downfall. You may add your own strength at a certain point. In other words, when you're throwing someone in judo, there is a point when his own strength has taken him beyond the peak. You know, when a thing is falling over, it reaches a certain peak where it's gone. You see, it's on the way down. It is at this moment that you add your strength and say, wowie, you see. When there's a curious throw in judo where you get a fellow, you've been holding him, and you get him up on your foot like this, you see. And then he is moving in this direction. So just when he's off balance, you whoops with your foot like that and send him way over on the floor in that direction. But he has to be beyond the falling point, you see, and then only do you use your strength. Because all you've done now in executing this throw was that you fell backwards with your own weight, and he was pushing at you. You see, at a moment when he was pushing at you like that, it is entirely opportune to put your foot up and fall over backwards, and he goes way over. And that's quite a throw to get involved in, I can assure you. But judo, you see, is a development out of the Taoist philosophy by probably Japanese people. Judo is relatively modern. It comes out of all sorts of understandings, going back to Chinese ways of doing things and gradually amalgamated into the form in which we know it today. But it is a basic demonstration of this principle of Wu Wei. So it isn't an attitude of total passivity. It isn't just doing nothing, as it literally says, not do. But it's really not force. So you need always, in every situation, to find out which way the wind is blowing. Trim your sails to the wind. This is the meaning of it. Well, now then, how do you know which way the wind is blowing? Obviously, a scientist would say to you, well, we have to make a very careful analysis of the situation and find out just what's going on. And then this becomes extremely interesting because now scientists are doing this very seriously. And they have devised the very important science that we call ecology. And in ecology, we study the whole complex of relationships which lie between any organism and its environment. And when we get to the ecology of mankind, it is simply fantastic. When you study, for example, the ecology between man and the world of microbes, and you try to decide what are good guys and bad guys among the microbes, how to get rid of the bad guys without getting rid of the good guys, and then realizing you need some of the bad guys, otherwise the good guys fall apart. And some of the killers we use are on the level of medicine, very much like what DDT is on the level of agriculture. It's too indiscriminate. And it gets too many of the good guys along with the bad guys. But you become, after a time, very doubtful as to the precise definition of a good guy and a bad guy. Because, you see, every group, every species, has to have an enemy. That's part of the whole mutual eating society arrangement of life. If you don't have an enemy, then you start multiplying too much. Nothing prunes you. Then you start getting in your own way. Because there are too many of you, you start eating up all your own supplies of foodstuff. Also, you get soft. You're not on the qui vive. You develop flabby muscles because you never get involved in a fight. So gradually, the successful group fails. The group which managed to obliterate all its enemies will fall apart. But that's the way things run. And the question is, you see, can we run the human race without awful bloodshed and murders and tortures and all that kind of thing? Can we somehow introduce a new kind of gamesmanship as a substitute for war? It's the same thing in business. Exactly. If you wipe out your competitor, then you have no reason to produce anything but a lousy product. And then you may make lots of money because you wiped out your competitors, you've got the whole market. And then you've got this money, what are you going to buy with it? Well, there's nothing to buy except other people's lousy products who wiped out their competitors. Or who cheated the public by packaging the thing to look elegant but it was nothing inside. That's all you've got to buy. So naturally, if you're a success in General Motors, you go and buy a Rolls Royce from England. Or you go and buy a Mercedes from Germany because they happen to be better cars. Or if you want to make a lot of money in the clothing industry here, making wretched prints, and you want some good clothes, what do you do? Well, you have to go to Mexico and buy the things peasants wear because they're still substantial, solid, damn good clothes. So you see, there's something always self-defeating in these attempts to succeed. You could say nothing fails like success. So for this reason, then, the Taoist always had an attitude of caution. Cautious, Lao Tzu says, as one who crosses a river in spring. That means either because of the spring floods or because the ice is still there and you're not quite sure how strong it is, because it's beginning to thaw. So, what the Taoist tries to develop is a sensibility to the situation. He tries to feel out intuitively what kind of action is required under these circumstances, because he feels that he can never discover it analytically with his conscious attention alone. Well, now, to talk in modern Western terms about how this is done, we must realize, of course, that we are equipped inside our heads with an absolutely fantastic thing called the brain. With its millions and millions of neuron cells, It is, as it were, the most amazing computer ever devised. Basic to the Taoist attitude to life is that you have that within you, and you may, if you don't know anything about brains very much, call it intuition or something of that kind. But you have within you the most amazing logical analyzer that exists in the known world. And the point is to get it to work for you. And instead of trying with conscious attention alone, which can only think of about three things at a time without using a pencil. That is to say, keep three variables in mind at once. Very few people can do four without using a pencil. You can do four if you're a trained musician, where you've got you're playing four different lines of a fugue, say. You're keeping four variables in mind at once. With an organist, you can go from four to six, because you've got your 2 feet, and they're playing too. But that requires a high amount of training to be able, with conscious attention, to keep these many variables in mind. But the world around us has infinitely many variables going in it. And you can reason out something with your conscious verbal thinking. Say you want to make a contract in business, and you figure out how to make it, whether it will be a good contract, whether it will work, etc., etc. And you think of all these things and write them down, and you make the contract, and you think that's fine. But one of the variables that you couldn't possibly include in the contract was that your partner would slip on a banana skin and break his neck. The contract might make provisions in it, if your lawyer was thoughtful, for what was to be done under the case of the disability of any of the parties thereto, etc. But eventually, there are so many possibilities that can occur that you cannot think of them all. So then the question arises, is it within the power of the human brain to comprehend, because of its immense complexity, in a kind of un- or subconscious way, what the surface consciousness can never grasp? And the Taoist would say, certainly it can. That you've got to learn to use your brain by allowing it to go to work on your problems without interfering with it. And then it will deliver you a decision. And this is why, when you get to the real study of Taoist and Zen Buddhist practice, you get to the point where you learn to act without making decisions. Or rather, to use a more exact word, without choosing. Krishnamurti talks a great deal about being choicelessly aware. And he says freedom is precisely the state of not having to choose. Now that sounds quite paradoxical, because we're always talking about freedom of choice. But choice is not a form of freedom in the sense of the word. What is choice in the sense of the word? Choice is the act of hesitation that we make before making a decision. It is a mental wobbling. You know, some people, when they take up a pen to write, they don't just write, but they jiggle the pen around indecisively like this and then start writing. Or a person comes into a room and wonders who to talk to and sort of is in doubt, you see. In that moment, he's choosing. Whereas a person who comes into a room and decides who to approach, he doesn't wait to choose. We say he is decisive. But that's a funny saying, because it means he doesn't stop to decide. So in the training in Zen Buddhism, which is simply a Buddhist extension of Taoism, Zen Buddhism arose out of the marriage of Buddhism and Taoism in the 5th century AD, and over the following centuries. So they have a way of training you so that you always act without choosing. For example, there was one day a leaky roof, and there were a couple of monks attending the Zen master. And he said, the roof is leaking. One monk disappeared and came back instantly with a sieve. and put it under the drips. Another monk, after some time, came back with a bucket. The master praised the one who brought the sieve. Now, the action wasn't exactly appropriate, to catching rain. But the point was that he was in the spirit of the Zen discipline by acting without choosing. And you will notice this with certain people. Certain people never hesitate. They always seem, if something needs to be done, they seem somehow simply to grab something and do it, which is a kind of a Zen capacity. So what happens is this, that the teacher of Zen constantly throws curves at his students and puts them in dilemma situations where they have to act immediately. One of the things, of course, that you mustn't do is rush, because rush is a form of hesitation. When a person rushes to get a train, he starts to fall over his own feet. See? So it really holds him up. It's like trying to drive at high speed through the water with a blunt-nosed boat. That's rush. But now what he's trying to get is a kind of a smooth, unhesitating, flowing action that is the response to the challenge. And it must be done with what is called another use of this word, mu. This is called wunyan in Chinese or munen in Japanese. And this word, nen, is composed of the character meaning now and the character meaning mind-heart, shin. And so has the meaning of a thought. But especially for us, it is well translated by the psychological term blocking. You're blocking, you say to someone, when they hesitate, when they dither, when they stop to choose. So the attitude of munen, or wunyan, is the unblocked mind, where it doesn't hesitate ever. Just as the river doesn't hesitate when it flows, and just when you clap your hands, the sound comes out without hesitation. And when the moon rises, the water doesn't wait to reflect it. It reflects it instantly. So that instant reflection, or it's a kind of resonance, is what is looked for as a response of the individual to his environment. And he does this to the degree that he knows himself to be one with his environment. Then his capacity for response increases in according to the way in which he feels that he is simply all of a piece with it and not something that is in it and with a barrier around him through which messages have to get and then their decisions have to be made up and sent out. So then, you could say that a kind of extremely subtle sensory awareness has to be developed as between the individual and his environment, so that he feels it out. Now, today, this sort of talk is very unpopular, because scientifically minded people, especially academic scientists, those who teach in universities, are exceedingly suspicious of intuitive reactions. They say, you can get into all sorts of trouble that way. But the thing that they neglect to realize is that everybody uses it. Even the most meticulously careful, analytical, rigorous, sound scientist uses intuitive judgment after a certain point. Why? Because you may accumulate data forever, and you may decide